case today, Properties Unlimited versus Kendant Mobility.
May it please the court, Carmen Caruso for the plaintiff in the case below, Properties Unlimited, which is a real estate brokerage firm up in Gurnee, Illinois. And we are the appellant in the main appeal and the appellee in the cross appeal. And that puts us in the position of arguing that there was error on the merits in the decision below, but correctness as to the procedures and the discretionary exercise of those procedures.
Mr. Caruso, could we start out by discussing that old bugaboo jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because when Judge Moran vacated his May 24th dismissal order, he did so in order to relieve Properties Unlimited of the need to appeal while the motion to reconsider was pending.
Yes.
But does a district judge have the power to circumvent appellate rule 4 in this way by, in effect, extending the appeal more than 30 days?
I believe that Judge Moran acted correctly because the motion to reconsider, the underlying motion to reconsider on the merits had been filed before the first extension of the time to appeal, so that when we came to about day 56, when the second deadline would have expired on July 26th, we asked for a status conference, and at that status conference, Judge Moran was focusing on the motion to reconsider, stating that I'm granting that to the limited extent that I want to be able to consider it in full without being hamstrung by the deadline to appeal.
But Judge Rovner's question is, whether that's what he said, whether he was well motivated, aren't really the issues. Does he have the power to extend more than 30 days the time for filing an appeal? We've said no, actually. I mean, the courts of appeals in general have said you can't do that. And what he didn't do was sort of interesting. He didn't, you know, actually restore the case to the docket for further proceedings. He didn't grant the 60B motion that was then pending before him. He just did something to say, I'm going to take more time.
Well, he indicated, though, that he was vacating the previous memorandum and order. And that was in the minute order in effect at the time, and then later he's made clear for us that he did intend to vacate the whole thing if there was any question on the record.
Well, but that, of course, is the problem. He had no power to end that order.
Your Honors, I believe that he did have authority on July 24th to vacate his previous decision in May because he was not acting to extend the appellate period by an additional 30 days under Appellate Rule 4. He was simply stating that I am granting the motion to the limited extent necessary to vacate the May 28th judgment so that there's no time to appeal anymore. It wasn't an extension. It was vacating the previous order.
Well, of course, but he never says he's vacating the judgment, number
right.
One. And number two, he never reinstates the judgment itself. He never says, I'm reinstating the judgment. You can search the record high and low, and you don't find any Rule 58 judgment in September.
That's correct. Your Honor, I believe that to the extent the court disagrees with Judge Moran's power to do what he did in July at the status conference, And while I disagree, I think that takes me to the exceptional circumstances or unique circumstances doctrine that comes from the U.S. Supreme Court and which this court has recognized in its Newell decision about a year ago. And in both the Supreme Court case and this case, this court's Newell decision, the court was faced with a factual situation very similar in which a party came to the district court within the 30 days to appeal and sought relief. And the district court granted that relief within the 30 days to appeal. And the party, the plaintiff, the eventual appellant, became in a position of relying on that grant of relief by the district court. And, of course, if the district court had said no, if the district court would say, no, I can't do this for whatever reason, there would still have been time to appeal left. And that was true both in June and it was true in July. In both cases, we went to Judge Moran and asked him for relief if he would consider the motion to reconsider. And he was persuaded that he had the discretionary authority to grant that procedural relief. And I relied on it at the time. I don't think there's any reasonable reliance test in the Newell decision or in the Supreme Court case, although I do consider that the reliance to have been reasonable on two orders of the district court.
Is Newell a published or unpublished opinion? Do you know?
I have a citation to 42 Federal Appendix 830.
Yeah, I know.
And
it's probably unpublished. Okay.
And the Supreme Court case is, of course, published, in which Newell relied.
Well, Harris is what you're talking about.
And I think in both Harris and Newell, the facts as to what happened in the first 30 days of the appellate period were much, much more egregious in terms of a possible error by the district court in attempting to extend the deadline to appeal. In the Harris case, there was a blatant attempt to grant a second 30-day extension under the appellate rule. Judge Moran didn't do that in this case. In July, he specifically stated that I'm vacating the previous decision. And in the Newell case itself, there was a late-filed Rule 59 motion filed, I believe, on the 24th day after the judgment had been entered, and the district court thought the Rule 59 motion was timely. The court of But ultimately, this court said that while the Rule 59 motion in Newell was untimely, that nonetheless, the exceptional circumstances or unique circumstances doctrine would apply. So, again, I would ask this court to invoke that doctrine if you're convinced that Judge Moran abused his discretion under Rule 60 or under Appellate Rule 4. But I do believe that while the district judge believed he was right, and I thought he was right at the time, and I didn't see any cases where on the initial Rule 60 motion, or how it was converted to a Rule 60 motion in June when it was presented and the timing issue was raised, all the cases that talked about how it was inappropriate to use Rule 60 to seek relief on the merits, those were all cases in which a party had come to the district court long after the initial 30 days had expired, and they came in arguing for relief. And in those circumstances, this court has held on many occasions in the cases that have been cited in the briefs that it's inappropriate to come back after the window has been closed to try and reopen it and get a new hearing on the merits or to start a new clock on the appeal.
But that doesn't change the nature of Rule 60 itself. I mean, Rule 60, we've said many times, is not a vehicle for just asking to correct an error of law. Indeed, one of the cases the parties have cited actually was a diversity case in which the state Supreme Court had changed the rule of law. Our prior decision was obviously wrong, given what the state Supreme Court had then done, and yet we said it was still not an abuse of discretion to deny Rule 60 relief, because there has to be finality to cases too.
I think the finality attaches after the 30 days when there's reliance on the finality. During that first 30 days, the only question was whether I was going to come straight to the Court of Appeals or persuade Judge Moran to reconsider. And so there was no finality in that sense. We had every ability to come to the Court of Appeals within the first 30-day period in June, while the motion to reconsider was first presented, before he extended the appellate deadline for the first time from mid-June until late July. And at that point, again, when we asked for the status conference, because we were aware that the extended 30 days was about to expire and the motion to reconsider had not been decided, we were in full position to file a notice of appeal, and the only reason we didn't in either June or July is because Judge Moran granted procedural relief that we relied upon.
Could I ask you whether there was any conversation around that July 24th status hearing about whether Judge Moran was in fact vacating the entire judgment that had been
put on the correct Rule 58 form, or whether it was simply the underlying order.
And there's no transcript because we were in Judge Moran's chambers, and then he issued a minute order. My understanding is that he stated that he was vacating the previous decision so that there would be no time to appeal, and that presumed the judgment or the judgment order.
That's what you understood anyway.
It's what I understood based on his words that he was eliminating the need to appeal in 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Had he not said that, then I would not have relied on it, and I would have had to file a notice of appeal, which is why we were there asking for the status conference in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that I've reached what I had reserved for rebuttal time. I was hoping to discuss.
You can handle your own time how you like. You can carry into it or just wait till.
I'd like to briefly address the merits, and that is that on this parole evidence clause, where the parties have multiple agreements over different periods of time when the agreements are signed, the starting point for analysis of the integration clause is what is the subject matter of the agreement that the integration clause would apply to. And as we've tried to demonstrate in the brief, we have one agreement, one associate broker's agreement signed in 1999. And we contend that the subject of associate brokerage is just that, and any integration clause in that agreement would have only applied to what are the terms of the associate relationship while that particular agreement is in force for the next year, and that it would not, really under any stretch, apply to an oral agreement that was entered in 1997 for the parties to eventually have a principal brokerage relationship, which under the Coldwell franchise system and the Cendant Mobility Program was a completely different relationship than the associate broker's agreement.
Then how do we deal with that integration clause that says that any previous agreements between the parties on the same or similar subject matter are canceled and are null and void? Why wouldn't that be sufficient to nullify any oral promises?
Well, that was Judge Moran's holding, but again, our contention is that we're talking about a separate agreement that is beyond the subject matter of an associate brokerage agreement.
Why isn't at least a similar subject matter? It's the same relationship. It's not like you all of a sudden decided to open up a McDonald's too on the side or something. It's all in the same package of discussions.
It was a completely different document. Had there been had we received a principal
brokerage, but it says same or similar.
We would have received a completely different contract. There was no reasonable expectation that promises about principal brokerage would have been written into an associate brokerage document.
But it could be that they were canceled by the associate brokerage document, because an integration clause could also say there are no other promises on the side. This is it. This is what you're getting.
Well, had they received the principal brokerage document, it would not have been found in that same document. It would have been a separate agreement in its entirety,
How today can we know that, sitting here?
I believe that that's the question of fact that should not have been resolved on the pleadings.
But the other thing that I'm trying to figure out is how you can establish detrimental reliance on the promise that it would have become the principal broker, because you say that promise was what kept Properties Unlimited in the Coldwell Banker system, but the franchise agreement, it seems to me, obligated Properties Unlimited to remain in that system through 2002.
At the time,
so, you know, we have to indulge in inference that the plaintiff otherwise would have breached that agreement by leaving the system.
We think that the plaintiff had a very substantial argument that after Cendant acquired the Coldwell system, that they breached, the franchisor breached the franchise agreement by taking away a very lucrative referral program and substituting something that over time proved to be seriously inadequate, and that they persuaded the franchisees to remain in the system by making all of these promises which we've alleged, and in the case of these plaintiffs, the most important promise being that at first opportunity you will receive a principal brokerage agreement. Until then, you're only an associate broker. and they signed those associate brokerage agreements. But the plaintiffs gave up the opportunity to break away from the system. There's no non-compete clause. At most, in the worst case for the plaintiff, Sandant or the Coldwell franchisor could have alleged breach of contract.
Well, they gave up an opportunity to have a lawsuit with Coldwell Banker, because if they had chosen to break away from the system 2 years into this contract, there would have been a lawsuit about who breached first and
yes.
who owed what to whom, and it's speculative at best to know from this distance who would have won such a lawsuit.
I don't think that there's a case in the case within the case requirement for this plaintiff's action, Your Honor.
Okay.
I could see that the red light is on. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Russo. Ms. Morenzi.
May it please the Court. Good morning. I am Paula Morenzi on behalf of Sendent Corporation and its affiliate Sendent Mobility. I would note for the Court that the franchisor is not before the Court, because Mr. Caruso did sue them, and they were separately governed by an arbitration clause that's set forth in the pleadings that are before the Court. Your Honors, the District Court properly exercised its discretion on September 25, 2002, to deny the plaintiff's Rule 60B motion. I would urge the Court to keep two things in mind as we discuss that issue today. The first is that an evaluation of what Judge Moran did on September 25th is guided by the abuse of discretion standard. And the second factor I'd ask the Court to keep in mind is that there were no 60B factors in the motion to reconsider brought by the plaintiff. Instead, it was a general state court motion to reconsider, and without Rule 60B factors, the September 25th ruling was an appropriate one.
But could I ask you, Ms. Morenzi, it does seem to me that at this stage, you've either been, I don't want to say opportunistic, but you have taken advantage of an opportunity that was handed to you by now arguing that the order of the district court on the 24th of July was not a wholesale vacation of the judgment itself. It was simply something that vacated the order, and thus there was, it's possible to avoid consideration of the underlying merits outside of that abuse of discretion standard. It surely would have been possible, don't you think, for the judge to have restored the case to the docket, set it for trial, done whatever he might have wanted to do as of July 24th?
Many things would have been possible, Your Honor, but in answer to that question, I would note that we truly believe that the judgment remained in place, because otherwise there would be no 60B motion to keep briefing. What it appeared Judge Moran had done was to go back to square one in his reasoning underlying the motion to dismiss that he had granted.
And then did you actually think this at the time, or is this something that came up later? Because it certainly seems that everybody thought the judge was just vacating whatever it is he had done on May 24th.
Your Honor, we actually thought that he had vacated his reasoning and therefore called for briefing on what the parties called the substance of the underlying issues, and that's why there was supplemental briefing in August. But we truly believe that the judgment remained in place, because otherwise there would have been no Rule 60B. We would have been back to a motion to dismiss. But to the point of Your Honor's comment about opportunism, I would like to quote Judge Kaney on that subject, who said in the Talano case, it is not the duty of the district court or of the opposing party to advise a moving party whether his appeal clock is ticking. And I think that would be a fair description of what was happening here. Turning to the issue that Judge Rovner raised of jurisdiction, I think it is fair to say that the district court did not have the power to circumvent the very plain language of Rule 4A5, which limits the extension of the time to appeal to the time period set forth in 4A5, and that is 30 days after the original time period.
But why shouldn't we nonetheless treat the appeal as timely under Harris and its progeny?
Harris, Your Honor, which was decided under Rule 73 before 4A5 right. came into effect, actually looks like it imposed a 4A5 time limit, because it extended for 30 days after the original 30-day limit. But on the unique circumstances doctrine in general, I would urge the court to keep in mind that neither of the two requisite factors are before this court. First, the plaintiff performed no act which, if properly performed, would have extended the time for appeal. It is helpful to look at this case in two parts. The first is the extension of time that Judge Moran granted in June when he extended the maximum possible relief under Rule 4A5. And then we turn to July when the 60B motion on procedural grounds was fully briefed, but the opinion was not ready, and what the court did was extend beyond the 4A5 period or attempt to by vacating his reasoning, or at least that's the position Mr. Caruso is taking today.
Did you or whoever appeared there object in any way to what Judge Moran was doing? Were there any objections? I understand that some of it isn't on the record.
None of it is on the record, Your Honor, and that is the difficulty, which leads us to the second unique circumstances factor. Neither Mr. Caruso nor I were at that status conference. Mm-hmm. Our very surprised associates emerged from Judge Moran's chambers with word that he was vacating the May 24th order, and the minute order is the only written record of what happened, and no one has suggested in the briefing before this court that there were any express assurances from a judicial officer, even if one could be relying on a minute order or, even worse, an oral conversation. So the answer is there were no statements, there was no waiver, which of course there couldn't be, of subject matter jurisdiction, but there were no statements either way. And there were no statements from Judge Moran himself.
Even if he neglected, you know, to expressly vacate the judgment itself, wasn't Judge Moran's intent clear? And then, of course, he clarifies that intent in that February 2003 order.
Your Honor, I come back to the issue that Judge Wood and I were discussing, and that is his intention was not clear because if he were vacating the judgment, then the Rule 60B briefing wouldn't be continuing to the point of a decision. There would be nothing to brief. So as we looked at this issue in July of 2002, there was simply the minute order. There was no assurance about the timeliness of any action by the plaintiff. There was no statement about this tolling the period for appeal. There were no express statements, as the court found in Thompson or in Newell, which was an unpublished decision, but in Thompson and Newell, the court had expressly said Rule 59E filings were timely made, even when they were not. And that was in the orders issued by those courts, so a party could reasonably rely on those express statements by a judicial officer. We lack that. We are much more like the Bond decision, in which this court noted that even a minute order does not constitute an affirmative representation necessary to invoke the unique circumstances doctrine. So here we have neither an affirmative act by the plaintiff to ask for an extension of time. All they moved for was a status conference. We have a sua sponte vacating of the court's opinion, but allowing briefing to continue on the 60B motion from the existing judgment. And we have no representations from the court below that there was to be any effect on the time period for appeal. I would direct the court's attention to the Tolano decision, which I think is instructive here. And that is Tolano versus Northwestern, where the court found no grounds for allowing the application of the unique circumstances doctrine, because there was, in that case, an empty Rule 59 motion, which the court deemed late. It had a supplemental opinion or a supplemental memo later. And the court, while it accepted the memorandum, gave no assurances that the appeal clock was not running. And the plaintiff then tried to appeal from the initial summary judgment order as well as the later denial of its motion to reconsider. This court held that there was no appellate jurisdiction over anything but the denial of the motion to reconsider and no abuse on Rule 60B grounds because there had been a general plea for relief, no enumeration of grounds, and a proper denial. So I think that's very close to what we have in front of this court today.
If we go on to the promissory fraud question, if there's a distinction between a principal broker and an associate broker, as you all seem to agree, then why would the integration clause in the 99 associate broker agreement reach any promise with respect to Properties Unlimited becoming a principal broker?
He reaches it for two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that, as the plaintiff concedes, the status of associate broker and the status of principal broker are mutually exclusive. You cannot be one at the same time. So by entering into an associate broker agreement, one is not becoming a principal broker. But the second reason is that...
Well, that begs the question. So let's go to the second.
And the second one is that there was in this agreement what I think is fairly termed a no-reliance clause, if we analogize it to Vigortone. There was language in this agreement that said the parties disclaim any prior understandings, they disclaim prior agreements, this is the one they're entering into, it is complete, it can be changed only in writing. And so the drafting truly precluded reasonable reliance on the circumstances before the plaintiffs as any assurance that they would become, as they have alleged, the sole principal broker. But second, there was no detrimental reliance and could not be, because here the only reliance they have alleged is remaining in the Coldwell Banker system, an obligation they had undertaken by contract in 1995. And they claim they relied by not suing their franchisor, but in fact they did sue their franchisor in this complaint and then dismissed voluntarily in view of the arbitration clause. Your Honors, to depart from the principles of Tolano and from the approach that the Second Circuit took in Cody would permit effectively an end run around the provisions of Rule 4A5. What it would mean is that a finality of judgment could no longer be presumed, and the final judgments issued by our district courts could be treated essentially as interlocutory judgments, modifiable at any time. Properties Unlimited's desire to have both a motion to reconsider and an appeal, and the judge's sympathy to fulfill that desire and look at their issues again, do not confer appellate jurisdiction on this court and cannot. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Crusoe, your time was up, but I'll give you a minute to respond if you'd like.
I was prepared to correct the record in that I did attend the status conference before Judge Moran on July 24, 2002, and I came away with the specific understanding that the previous decision, the order, was all being vacated for the purpose of appeal, and that's what I relied upon. And I'd like the record to be clear on that fact. As to the argument about finality, again, we never went beyond 30 days to appeal. In June and July, we always were within our time to file a notice of appeal consistent with all of the rules, and we asked Judge Moran for procedural relief, and we received it. And we received specific relief that's now been called into question, but under the circumstances of relying on that relief, I would invoke the Harris case and stand on that as to the exceptional circumstances doctrine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christie. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.